From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with the actor who led 8,000 extras across the Red Sea, won a death-defying chariot race, and was chased by futuristic apes, Charlton Heston. Also today, we talk with Nicholas Kazan. He wrote the screenplays for Reversal of Fortune, Patty Hearst, and At Close Range. Rock historian Ed Ward explains how American record companies of the 60s kept trying to combine the blues with American pop. And critic Maureen Corrigan reviews Iron John, a new book about what men want, by poet Robert Bly. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Dale Willman. In a dramatic speech this morning, the president announced a new diplomatic effort in an attempt to resolve the crisis in the Persian Gulf. Next month, Secretary of State James Baker will travel to Baghdad if allowed, and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz has been invited to come to Washington. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Speaking to concerns raised by members of Congress and many Americans about military action in the Gulf, the president referred to Vietnam and said he will never agree to a halfway effort.
This will not be a protracted, drawn-out war. The forces arrayed are different. The opposition is different. The resupply of Saddam's military would be very different. The countries united against him in the United Nations are different. The topography of Kuwait is different. And the motivation of our all-volunteer force is superb.
The president's speech seemed to be directed both at Saddam Hussein and critics in Congress. It was a stern warning about the use of force, and yet at the same time, an announcement of a new diplomatic effort. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the White House.
Iraq's ambassador to France has welcomed an offer by President Bush to hold direct talks on the Gulf crisis, yet there was little official reaction from Baghdad itself. NPR's Jackie Leiden reports.
Iraqi Ambassador Abdul Razak al-Hashimi called President Bush's offer to send Secretary of State Baker to Iraq a very important step, and we hope it's going to achieve what we are all striving for, negotiations instead of beating the drums of war. But in Baghdad on Saturday, Iraq has organized special demonstrations to protest the UN Security Council vote against it. In Jordan, while there was no direct word from the government, some officials were declaring the offer for direct talks a victory. This is what Jordan has hoped for all along, said one. But the Jordanian press has come out with blistering attacks against the United States for its double standards on the Palestinian issue. The UN Security Council resolution was also condemned by the PLO, but other Arab officials in the Middle East said talks between Baker and Iraqi Foreign Minister Tariq Aziz could be a cover for Arab negotiations that might take place and avert war. I'm Jackie Leiden in Amman.
U.S. military officials said today they're going to send more warplanes to the Persian Gulf. Defense Department officials say as many as 300 more fighters and other military aircraft will begin heading to the Gulf area next week. When all the planes arrive, the U.S. will have more than 1,000 planes in the Persian Gulf area. The planes being sent will also include a number of stealth fighters, which will join the 22 that are already in the area. On Wall Street, stock prices soared today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed up just over 40 points to finish the day at 2559.65. Advances led declines by a margin of about 3-1 on trading of some 184 million shares. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. I've been thinking about the movie My Dinner with Andre. After the playwright Andre Gregory describes traveling around the world, pushing himself to extremes, burying himself alive, seeking the true meaning of life in theater, the playwright Wally Shawn makes a nice case for staying home.
Well, do you want to know my actual response to all this? I mean, do you want to hear my actual response?
Yes.
I mean, I'm just trying to survive, you know? I mean, I'm just trying to earn a living, just trying to pay my rent and my bills. I mean, I live my life. I enjoy staying home with Debbie. I'm reading Charlton Heston's autobiography, and that's that.
I was thinking about that scene because I was reading Charlton Heston's autobiography in preparation for today's interview. Of course, I also found myself thinking about Moses.
From the burning bush, O Lord, you charged me to bring the people to this holy mountain.
to behold your glory and receive your law. What have I left undone?
Charlton Heston's voice reverberated in other biblical spectacles like Ben-Hur and The Greatest Story Ever Told. He not only was close to God in his movies, he played the genius Michelangelo in The Agony and the Ecstasy. He was a cop in Orson Welles' Touch of Evil and a lonely cowboy in Will Penny. He was the pursued in The Planet of the Apes and was subjected to earthquakes and airplane catastrophes in the disaster films of the 70s. But before we talk about that, there's the subject of Heston's new book, Beijing Diary. It covers his 1988 trip to China, where he directed a Chinese adaptation of the Kane Mutiny court-martial. None of the actors spoke English, and none of them knew who Heston was.
No Western film made since 1947, 48, has ever been shown in China commercially. You see them occasionally at embassies and things like that, but no, I was re-explored the interesting experience of anonymity while I was in China.
What happened to the People's Art Theater who you were directing with? What happened to them after Tiananmen Square?
They closed it. My cast caught up, as many, many Chinese were, especially artists, in the spirit of democracy that had been flowering carefully in the preceding year or so, demonstrated in Tiananmen Square on the second day of the demonstrations, wearing the cast jackets I'd given them all as presents, with the title of the play in Chinese characters on the back, Kane Mutiny Court Martial. And the largest of those characters was the Chinese character for mutiny, and that was not the kind of thing to wear on your back in Tiananmen Square. To the best of my knowledge, through limited information, none of my actors was imprisoned or injured physically. But they did pull the power at the theater into the... As far as I know, it's still closed.
Let's look at your career in movies and television. Back in 1950, you were signed by Hal Wallace, who was an independent producer. The studios were kind of in that transitional period of breaking up.
No, the studio system was still in place.
Mm-hmm.
Marlon Brando had gone into movies about a year before I did, and he had the first non-exclusive contract.
Yeah, so what did it mean to sign with an independent as opposed to a studio?
Well, the crucial thing was not independent or not. He was, in fact, an independent at Paramount using their facilities. But he was willing to give me what the studios would not do, which was a non-exclusive contract that gave me the right to do plays, to do television, to do films for other people.
Mm-hmm.
I owed Hal five movies, of which he, in fact, only made one himself, and he sold the rights to the others, which, of course, was entirely appropriate. I had no objection to that, but I was delighted to have the kind of freedom that now is routine. There's no such thing as exclusivity among actors and directors, but up to that time, the studio system was absolutely in control of all the creative talent.
What kinds of roles were you considered best suited for early in your career in the first part of the 1950s?
Well, obviously, large fellows with broken noses and bass voices. That's to begin with. Any actor is stuck with his own physical equipment. There are some actors, Olivier, who aside from the fact that he's the best actor of the century, was also gifted with kind of a physical neutrality. He was neither very tall, nor certainly not short. I think he was barely under 6 feet. He had a voice of medium baritone range and a very handsome but regular face. And he could go anywhere. He could and did play Shylock and Lear and Hamlet and Antony. See, I could never play Romeo or Hamlet, just as Dustin Hoffman can't play Macbeth. So I sort of had to play captains and kings and emperors and cardinals and cowboys and cops in that line of country, which I've done both on stage and screen for most of my career.
You mentioned a broken nose. Did your nose actually get broken?
When I was playing football in high school, which I did unsuccessfully. But the nose was a great asset. I've gotten a lot of parts out of that nose.
I'm tempted to say...
Believe me, it's true.
I'm tempted to say they were able to cast you as Moses because with a broken nose you look more authentically Jewish.
No, more specific than that. In part because of the broken nose, I look remarkably like probably the greatest rendition of Moses in existence, the Michelangelo statue of Moses in the chapel at San Pietro in Vincoli in Rome. It's undoubtedly the most famous representation of Moses, and I do look quite a lot like it. Somebody pointed this out to DeMille while he was casting the picture, and apparently he couldn't get it out of his mind.
Charlton Heston is my guest. In the Ten Commandments, you had to lead and to speak to a cast of thousands. Can you describe what went into one of those scenes, or one of the really large scenes where all the extras were?
Well, the Exodus is, I suppose, one of the largest scenes of that kind ever filmed.
Mm-hmm.
It had 8,000 human beings and 5,000 animals, and it took... To get the shots with all those people, you could only do about 5 takes a day, because you... To get them back to where they started from took hours. And it's the kind of film that obviously can never be made again. They won't ever make Lawrence of Arabia or Bridge in the River Kwai or Ben-Hur or any of those films again because they're far, far too expensive. I saw they ran the Ben-Hur budget, the original budget, which turned up in somebody's file drawer, through a modern computer program that production managers use when they're budgeting films. To make Ben-Hur today would cost $127,800,000.
Wow. So tell me something about what it was like to do the Exodus scene and the crossing the Red Sea scene with...
Well, you need the stick. You have to have the stick to do it. Did you notice what a nice day it was in New York yesterday? You're welcome. I'm glad to do it. Glad to help. But this obviously, those scenes are... In a sense, the English actors call NAR, no acting required. If you stand in front of 8,000 people in the Egyptian desert and lift up a stick and say, "Bear us out of Egypt, O Lord, as an eagle bears its young upon its wings," you don't need to act that. The scene does it for you. You are overwhelmed by the reality of what is around you.
Yeah, it must give you a real sense of power.
Indeed it does.
Even though it's all stage, you've still got, 8,000 people following
you. Yes, yes. It's quite an awesome experience.
Your infant son ended up playing the baby Moses in the bulrushes.
He began playing. He ended up a writer-director. I just finished working for him.
Oh, right, right.
So he began.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
was the beginning and end of his acting career.
Right.
I think he realized the shortcomings of... a career in front of the camera and quickly switched behind.
Well, how did your baby end up getting the part? I mean, the striking resemblance kind of didn't
I don't think a resemblance was a factor.
Yeah.
My wife, who was then an actress herself, was unable to go to Egypt on the location because she was carrying our then unborn son. And DeMille was obviously aware of this, and he said, "When is the baby due?" And she said, "In February." And he said, "That means that he will be 3 months old, if it's a boy, when we get to the shots of the infant Moses in the bulrushes." And he said, "If it's a boy, he can play the part." And at about an hour and a half after Fraser was born, which was 3 o'clock in the morning, she got a telegram from DeMille in the hospital. It said, "Congratulations, he's got the part."
I thought you were going to say, "Congratulations, it's a Moses."
No.
So they wouldn't have used your baby if it was a girl, huh? I mean, no one could tell in the movie.
No, I don't think so.
Well, you couldn't really tell, though, could you?
Well, and I think Jews would have been offended.
You did the voice of God, right? In the scene where Moses is on the mountain and God is telling the Ten Commandments.
Which I think is perfectly logical. Because where do we hear the voice of God? Inside our own heads, right? And whose voice speaks inside your head?
Yeah, that's an interesting way of looking at it. I'd like to ask you about the chariot race scene in Ben-Hur, which is, Ben-Hur won, 11 Academy Awards, mm-hmm. and the chariot race scene has always been considered one of the... One of the really important action sequences.
Yeah. Category for chariot races, though.
You're right. So you had to.
It is regarded, I suppose, as the best action sequence ever filmed, but it was not. It didn't win an award.
You had to learn how to actually drive a chariot for this?
Yes, I went over some 6 weeks before we started shooting, and Yakima Kanat, who directed the race sequence, personally taught me to drive. And by the time we were ready to begin the picture, I was a minimally competent charioteer. But as I pointed out to Yak one day while we were resting the horses after working a couple of hours with him, I said, you know, Yak, I can handle this team pretty well now, but there's just the one team out here. And when we start shooting this sucker, there's going to be 8 other teams, and I'm not so sure about I can cut that or not. And he looked at me and he said, Chuck, you just stay in the chariot. I guarantee you're going to win the damn race. As indeed I did.
So was everybody, were most of the other drivers stunt drivers so they could get out of your way
indeed,
real quick?
All of them. Mm-hmm. Well, Steve Boyd, who unhappily had not been cast until he only had about 3 weeks work in the chariot. But he drove some sequences as well.
Mm-hmm. There was all these scenes where...
action sequence, mm-hmm. if the principal has been trained to do whatever it is he's supposed to do well enough to be photographed doing it, you are surrounded by professionals. I mean, they were not about to run over me if I fell out of the chariot. I don't think they were.
And they didn't really run over Stephen Boyd when he fell out, right?
No. No. What was an accident... was I drove a great deal of the sequences, mm-hmm. but the scene where Ben-Hur is thrown out of the chariot when it jumps the wreck was not planned. He was not supposed to go out of the chariot, but he was accidentally thrown out with and I didn't do that. Joe Kanat, Yak's son, but Joe was thrown out of the chariot, managed to throw himself clear, and was only scratched. If the chariot had run over him, it would have killed him because those things weighed 1/2 ton with steel wheels. But then Weiler, who of course directed the picture, saw that footage, and he said, we got to use that shot. And Jack said, I thought Ben-Hur was supposed to win this sucker, Willie. How are we going to get him back in the chariot? And Willie said, well, we'll cut before he falls absolutely clear and have Chuck get in the tongue and climb back in, which I did very quickly.
Did that look convincing to you when it was cut together?
Oh, sure. Yeah, it's totally convincing. It was not my favorite shot to do, I'll tell you, but it's totally convincing.
You had to climb back in as the chariot was moving.
Yes, but I was on the tongue of the chariot between the horses and the chariot itself.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your movie career. And my guest is Charlton Heston, and he's written a new book called Beijing Diary, and it tells the story of his trip to China in 1988, where he directed an all-Chinese version of the Cane Mutiny court-martial. This is Fresh Air. Charlton Heston is my guest. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems to me in the epic movies that you made, one of the things you had to do was show a lot of bare chest.
Depends. I'm in certainly The Slave Galley in Ben-Hur. In Commandments in the Brickyards. Nothing in El Cid. I guess I was naked in Planet of the Apes for a couple of scenes. A certain amount of skin, no question. That's not unheard of these days either.
No.
What'd you say?
Absolutely. Have you been made some really ludicrous offers by people who wanted you to be at their event in some kind of quasi-biblical get-up or persona?
I think word has gotten around that
you don't do that. Yeah,
I wouldn't say that's a major problem.
Right,
it's come up once or twice, maybe. But
In 1969, you made the movie Planet of the Apes, which turned out to be a huge commercial success, one of the biggest movies of the year at the box office. What was your opinion of the script when you first looked at it and of the final film?
I was impressed by the script. I was a little surprised at the extraordinary success of the film because it took 2 years to get anyone to finance it. See, this was, I suppose, Planet of the Apes was the first of the space operas in which we are still awash. You know, Star Trek and Star Wars and so on, Return of the Jedi are all space operas. And at the time, the studio said, you guys are crazy. You want to do a film with spaceships and talking monkeys? This is like Buck Rogers, Saturday morning serials. And that's how they viewed the genre, which had not been touched since the Saturday morning serials of the 30s. And, of course, we had struck a nerve with audiences, as filmmakers are still discovering.
I figure all the actors in the movie really envied you because you didn't have to wear the ape makeup.
Indeed they did.
On the other hand, you had to take a lot of physical abuse in the film.
On the other hand, I didn't get to
film.
Wear any clothes in a couple of scenes either.
Well, you also had to take a lot of physical abuse.
It certainly was true. I didn't realize it until we were halfway through the picture, but in almost every scene, I either get hit or chased or whipped or netted or sprayed with fire hoses, and it was a strenuous undertaking. But it's a good film, and I'm very glad I made it.
Yeah,
especially since, in effect, it started a whole genre.
Mm-hmm. Is it exhausting to go through a day where you take that much abuse?
Well, making a film is exhausting.
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know, making a film, acting in a film, especially directing a film, is not fun. It's not supposed to be fun. A movie's supposed to be marvelous to watch, exciting, amusing, frightening, whatever, inspiring, whatever it's supposed to be. But making it it's not supposed to be fun for the people who make it. On the other hand, as Orson Welles said memorably, making a movie is the best set of electric trains any little boy ever had to play with. And both those statements are true, and if you can't understand them, I can't explain it.
In the 70s, you starred in several of the disaster films, including Earthquake, which was one of the first. How did you end up being in, what was it, four
we
of the
We were
films?
All in disaster films. The reason for that is very clear. Disaster films are, in essence, multiple Jeopardy stories. You take a natural disaster or a man-made disaster or a threatening circumstance and put a cast of disparate characters, a dozen or 15 people who don't know each other, most of them. And the point of the story is how they respond to the circumstances. And it's a perfectly valid genre. But if you're making a movie about it, you have these 12 or 15 people, and you introduce each one in a scene in the beginning. And they're usually not in the same scene because they don't know each other. They're not supposed to. That's part of the idea. Then you'd often don't see them again for half an hour. And if they come up again, you don't want the audience saying, let's see, who was that? Was that that fire chief in the beginning? And the guy said, then they want to say, no, that was Steve McQueen, dummy. This is Paul Newman. He plays the architect. And for that, you need very high profile, very well-known actors. And we all did at least two of them. And finally, they used up all the possible stories, and the audience got tired of them. And I think we were all tired of them, too, by then, but we made an awful lot of money out of them.
In Earthquake, you actually asked for your character to be killed at the end.
Well, I thought, I said, I didn't ask. I had script approval.
Oh, you did?
Oh, sure.
Oh.
And I said, come on, guys, this is ridiculous. I play this nice architect who knows there's going to be an earthquake, and they got to build the buildings differently, and he has this terrible wife and this nice mistress. And at the end of the picture, the earthquake proves that he's right about the buildings, and it kills his mean wife, and he gets to go on into a happy future designing earthquake-proof buildings with this beautiful Canadian girl, Geneviève Bujold. And I said, let's surprise him a little. Let's have him killed, too. And so they did.
Did you have to work hard to convince them?
Mm-hmm. I did.
Charlton Heston is my guest. You served a very long term as president of the Screen Actors Guild.
7 years, yeah. Longer than anyone.
I'm wondering if you feel that that affected your acting career at all, and if you felt that
No.
I wonder also if you feel that Hollywood has ever divided politically, like the kind of director who might hire your liberal counterpart Ed Asner, or the kind of director who would hire you. Do you know what I mean? In other words, if Hollywood in its casting ever splits along political lines,
I
conservative
certainly hope
and liberal.
Not. I'm sure Ed hopes so too. Although Ed is implied sometimes that is the case. I've never felt that.
Mm-hmm.
When I was president of the Guild, and up until that time, not only the officers, but most of the board members were very well-known actors. That is not true now, and I have no idea why that's true, except I suppose there are so many people in the Guild. There are now some 82,000 members of the Guild, which is a horrifying figure. But I've certainly never felt that not only my leadership of the Guild, but my political opinions in general have affected my employability. I still seem to be making a good living.
Did you ever see the movie My Dinner with Andre?
Yes. Yes, I know. I'm referred to favorably in that. And I guess that's the first time that's ever happened to me.
So when did you find out about it in the theater when you were watching the movie, or did you know by the time you saw the movie that your autobiography was mentioned?
I can't remember, frankly. I know two or three critics mentioned that, but I can't remember whether I read those comments before or after I'd seen the film. But I liked the film. I thought it was quite interesting.
And that must have been good for business, too.
Yeah, I don't know. I was not billed.
Okay. Your new book is Beijing Diary. It's based on the diary you kept while you're in Beijing in 1988 directing. You have an earlier book that's
also based on my journals.
Exactly. Are you still keeping a journal?
Oh, sure. Absolutely.
What kinds of things do you put in your journal? Do we just get to see part of it? I mean,
do you
have really personal things that you're not showing us?
It was begun as a work tool by 1957, 56, when I began keeping it. I had reached a point as an actor and director where I was having a lot of control over what I did and who I did it with and how it was done and all that stuff. And it occurred to me, since the working filmmaking community and playmaking community is actually a fairly small group, you tend to be working with the same people before many years have passed. If your career has any longevity, you find yourself working with the same cameramen, the same designers, the same actors, so forth, same directors. And I thought, if I write down what I think at the time, this will help me when I come to work with or consider working with these people again. So it began as simply that, a useful work tool. Since then, especially since I've now gotten two books out of it, I cast a wider net.
Charlton Heston, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you for giving me such a long visit with your audience. I enjoyed it enormously. I do thank you.
Thank you. My guest has been Charlton Heston, and he's written a new book about directing the Cane Mutiny in China. It's called Beijing Diary. Next time, Jim Jarmusch, director of the films Mystery Train, Stranger Than Paradise, and Down by Law. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Nicholas Kazan wrote the screenplays for Patty Hearst at Close Range and the new film Reversal of Fortune. All three films were based on real events. Coming up, we talk to Kazan about turning life into film. Also, rock historian Ed Ward shows how American record companies tried to create a hit sound in the 60s by making pop music out of the blues. And critic Maureen Carrigan reviews the book Iron John by poet Robert Bly. It's about what American men want and don't have and how they can get it. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush announced today that he wants to send Secretary of State James Baker to Iraq sometime between December 15th and January 15th for talks with officials. Mr. Bush has also invited the Iraqi foreign minister to Washington for consultations during the week of December 10th. Mr. Bush said the Baker trip is not a concession, but an effort to underscore U.S. determination. In New York City, U.S. officials say that they are willing to consider not vetoing a U.N. resolution on protecting Palestinians in the occupied territories, but they say the text of the measure has to be reasonable. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The U.S. will meet next week with four of the Security Council's non-aligned countries. Cuba, Yemen, Malaysia, and Colombia have prepared a resolution that would expand the U.N.'s role in the occupied territories. An American official said today the U.S. is willing to support the resolution, or at least abstain from voting on it, but he said certain sections must be modified, especially the part calling for a U.N. ombudsman to investigate alleged Israeli human rights abuses. Since Israel wouldn't cooperate, he said, such a resolution would be meaningless. The U.S. has supported two U.N. resolutions criticizing Israel this fall, and Israel has accused its longtime ally of caving into Arab pressures to preserve the anti-Iraq coalition. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In Iraq, officials have rejected a U.N. Security Council resolution to pull out of Kuwait and say if necessary, they will fight. The ruling council, led by President Saddam Hussein, said the resolution is not legal and is null and void because it was imposed by the United States. The foreign minister of China, Chen Qicheng, met with President Bush at the White House today, the first such meeting since the bloody crackdown on pro-democracy demonstrators last year. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Today's talks have provoked controversy because, in the words of the human rights group Asia Watch, the meeting comes at a time when repression in China is not lessening, but in fact seems to be intensifying. President Bush said he planned to raise human rights concerns in his talks with a foreign minister. Referring indirectly to China's stance against Iraqi aggression in the Persian Gulf, the president stressed that the U.S. and China have much in common.
China and the United States have made common ground in terms of standing up against aggression.
China did not vote for yesterday's UN resolution authorizing force against Iraqi troops in Kuwait, but the Chinese allowed the resolution to pass by not exercising their veto power. China merely abstained. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 41 points to close at 2,559.65, volume 192 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Later in the show, I'll talk with screenwriter Nicholas Kazan about his new movie, Reversal of Fortune. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward says there was a time when the white-run record industry in this country tried to make pop music out of the blues. But Ed says they never quite figured it out.
I am the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day. I'm the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day. Keep everything in the farmyard upset in every way.
When American teenagers started noticing the Rolling Stones, it was like a red flag going up for the U.S. pop music business. Since the Stones were constantly telling the press that they found their inspiration in American blues records, unless some American band started playing this music, it would become the property of the British. Even though it wasn't the blues tunes the Stones had hits with, the clue to the Stones' success must lurk somewhere in the blues. Naturally, this was a completely cockeyed way of looking at it, but that's never stopped the record business. And fortunately, the Stones got a lot of American bands interested in trying their hand at blues. What was missing, though, was a pop sensibility, the sort of thing the Stones could project effortlessly. The key was the Stones' complete isolation from the sources of the blues, from the all-pervasiveness of black music. But like I said, that didn't stop the record business. The first American band to get shoehorned into a pop single was the Paul Butterfield Blues Band, an integrated outfit from Chicago, who sounded profoundly uncomfortable when they recorded Mary Mary. The next band to record that did a little better with it. They were called the Monkees. Okay, maybe the Butterfield Band was a little gritty for pop success. The next big hope came from New York, just as the Stones had all come from London.
I saw my mother was falling, walking down the Folsom Road. She tried to make it in due time before the heaven doors closed.
The Blues Project couldn't be faulted on pop grounds. One of their members was Al Cooper, who'd been one of the royal teens of Short Shorts fame. But unfortunately, their records were pretty chaotic, and Danny Kalb's guitar playing in particular was notable for its excesses. In 1968, though, a record came out that had the seeds of two approaches for making pop music out of the blues. Although it was barely noticed at the time, the debut by Taj Mahal, whose real name was Henry Sinclair Fredericks, was a groundbreaker. Mahal's band featured two guitar virtuosos, a flashy one named Jesse Edwin Davis, and a subtle one named Ryland P. Cooter. Together, they came up with something real interesting.
Woke up this morning, baby, I had them stage bear blues. Stage bear Georgia, that is. Woke up this morning, had them stage bear blues. Looked over in the corner, grandma, grandma had them too.
Not only did Statesboro Blues become a standard among bands as different as the Youngbloods and the Allman Brothers, but the simplicity of Cooter and the rhythm section working together gave a band Taj had once worked with an idea.
I'm going up the country, baby, don't you want to go? I'm going up the country, baby, don't you want to go? To some place where I've never been before. I'm going where the water tastes like wine. I'm going where the water tastes like wine. We can jump in the water, stay drunk all the time.
Canned Heat was a bunch of Los Angeles record collectors who liked to play long, messy blues jams. But they could also tighten up to produce a few hit singles that were deeply rooted in the blues. But it was the other approach that eventually won out, and unfortunately for the Patriots, it was the British who beat us again.
Give you my love. I'm gonna give you my love. Oh.
course, all during this time, blues singers like B.B. King, Coco Taylor, Bobby Blue Bland, and Little Johnny Taylor were having hits with black audiences, ignored by progressive FM radio and the moguls who scoured the U.S. and Britain looking for the blues feel that could be a hit.
Ed Ward writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Nicholas Kazan writes screenplays based on real events. At Close Range starred Christopher Walken as a criminal father who murders one son and is out to get his other son, played by Sean Penn. Patty Hearst, directed by Paul Schrader, told the story of Patty Hearst's capture by the Symbionese Liberation Army. Kazan's new film, Reversal of Fortune, is about the Klaus von Bülow appeal. Von Bülow is convicted of assault with the intent to murder his wife, Sunny von Bülow. She remains in a coma. The movie is based on the book of the same name by Alan Dershowitz, the lawyer who won the appeal. But the film is told from the perspective of Sunny as she lies in a coma in her hospital room. Kazan says he got the idea for this unusual perspective from the film's producer, Ed Pressman.
Ed Pressman would say to me, we sent this to Brian De Palma, and De Palma said he'd only do it if Sunny was the hero. And then Ed would laugh, this little giggle of his, like, what a crazy idea. But Ed kept repeating this, and I thought, well, that's kind of interesting that he's repeating it. And I sat down to write the script, and I realized I had an enormous, as a writer, I had an enormous problem that basically seemed to be insoluble. A trial is an essentially dramatic form. Therefore, most movies that have something to do with crime or the law end up with a trial. My movie isn't about an appeal, you know, which is essentially about a 120-page document. Not dramatic at all. And I realized that Ed's little voice and his giggle kept coming back to me, and I realized that the one perspective that no one in the audience had was Sonny's. So just, when I was first trying to write the script, I began and I had her begin the movie. I realized as I went on with the script that this afforded me enormous benefits. Mostly it kept bringing back the fact of this woman lying in a coma in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital. Usually in a murder case, the deceased is quickly forgotten, and the pain and so forth associated with someone's removal from this earth is forgotten. Whereas here there's somebody who's kind of the living dead, and continually coming back to her body lying there was a way of reminding the audience of sort of the emotional stakes of what was being discussed.
Your co-producer on the movie was Alan Dershowitz, who's
right.
The son of the lawyer Alan Dershowitz. And
right.
The son has a small role in the movie. I mean, not the actual son, but the son is portrayed in a small part in the movie.
Correct.
And the father, Alan Dershowitz, is portrayed in a major role in the movie.
Correct.
It must have been kind of awkward for you working with someone who's portrayed in the movie and also having him be the co-producer. I don't know, you might have felt that you were expected to only show the positive side of those personalities.
Well, to a certain extent, my hands were tied less by Ilan's presence there than by Alan's skill as a lawyer. And I did have to portray Alan in a positive fashion. I should add that I after hanging out around with him and watching him teach at Harvard and watching him work on various cases, I grew to admire him a great deal. Had this been a fictional character, I would have been able to give the man perhaps more rough edges than I could under these circumstances. I was kind of in a catch-22. If I portrayed a fault that he did not have, then he would say, my God, you can't portray me that way. I'm not like that at all. And if I portrayed a fault that he did have, he would say, my God, you can't do that. I'm not like that at all.
Well, what official power did he have to look at the script and say, you can't do that. I'm not like that at all?
We could not betray him in a way which in any way besmirched his legal capabilities.
That was in the contract?
Yeah, that was in the contract. You know, there was no... That was an issue which essentially would not have come up. There was no point in making the film and making Dershowitz look like a bad lawyer. He's not a bad lawyer. It would have been foolish to attempt to do so, and as I say, legally, we could not have attempted to do so anyway. But he did not have any control over his character as it was portrayed.
Now, I want to ask you about an earlier script you wrote. You wrote the screenplay for a movie called It Close Range that was directed by James Foley and starred Sean Penn and Christopher Walken. From the little I've read about you talking about the movie, I think I probably like it more than you do. It's a movie I like a lot. You've been quoted as saying that you thought Sean Penn's ego got out of control, he was given too much power and he abused it, and that the script was really changed in the process.
Well, what remains, there are almost no words remaining in the film that I didn't write. I mean, there are a few improvised lines and so forth. But I do feel that there was an opportunity to make a really great film there, and what remains is, you know, a good film. But one of the reasons I'm pleased with The Reversal of Fortune is that audiences seem to find the humor in it. When we read At Close Range, when the cast got together to read that script, people laughed all the way through. And everyone finished and said, my God, I had no idea this was so funny. And the reason that they didn't have an idea was that the humor all emerged from character. There were no jokes in it. But the director and Sean Penn, for some reason, didn't have a sense of humor or did not want, more likely felt this was a serious film and that somehow the humor undercut the seriousness, which I believe the effect is the exact opposite. The more extreme the emotional circumstances, the more the audience desperately wants a chance to relieve its anxiety, its tension, at least momentarily, by laughing at something. And so I felt that there were... I'm glad you liked the film. It's funny, I always feel I'm happy when people like the film and I'm happy when people don't like the film. I'm happy they like it because I feel that some of what my original script got through, and I'm pleased when they don't like it because I feel that it could have been so much more.
When you talk about the humor in the film, are you talking about, for instance, in one of the last scenes when Sean Penn is holding a gun to his father, played by Christopher Walken, and, you know, the father has, like, shot Sean Penn's brother, shot Sean Penn's girlfriend, and he'd really like to murder Sean Penn, too. So finally, Sean Penn's got a gun on him, and his father says, Christopher Walken says, I got feeling for you, son. I love you. Is that what you want to hear? I love you. And it's really, in its own way, it's terrifying, but there's something very funny about it.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's that, you got it. I mean, as you were reading those lines back to me, I was laughing, you know, under my breath here because, you know, it's there is something weirdly funny about that, and that sensibility was all the way through, but what will produce a laugh is extremely delicate. The difference between a line reading that will evoke a laugh and a line reading that won't is almost imperceptible to some people, and if people are not looking for that dramatic element, if they don't want to include that in the film, they can simply use what I would say not the actor's best take, or a take of the line which is good, but just the comedic element is slightly dissipated. The timing is slightly different from the comedic reading, and then people won't laugh.
Now, your father is the director, Elia Kazan. Did that make you interested in movies, having a father who made such excellent movies? I wonder how much movies were screened or talked about in the house, how movie-conscious you were growing up.
My father never brought his work home. He never lived in Hollywood. My mother, who's long since dead, was an unsuccessful playwright. And I found myself in college becoming a writer, essentially following my mother's footsteps. I wrote short stories that weren't terribly good. And then I started to write plays, which is what my mother wrote, and they were pretty good. Essentially, what I'm trying to say is I made my own way.
Mm-hmm.
There is a certain glamour associated with the industry, which anyone would feel growing up. But in my family, they would always taunt me and say, your life is going to be a disappointment on your school teacher's salary after seeing all these famous people your father's associated with. And I would always smile and nod and file that away.
Have you felt prepared for some of the difficulties of working in the movie business? I mean, do you think that growing up in your family helped prepare you for the fact, for instance, that at least one of your script was going to be changed in ways you wouldn't like it?
The great advantage I had I lived in Berkeley at a few blocks from Patty Hearst's house, in a house with a group of people so that I could keep my expenses very low,
mm-hmm.
And worked for 10 years earning what was, by the government's definition, poverty-level income, which was what I lived on. And I think that the advantage I had, having grown up in my house, was that I had this perhaps naive belief or faith in myself, and a belief that if I kept working and learning my craft, that I would eventually become successful. Nothing can prepare a writer for having their work destroyed. And in fact, that didn't happen a great deal didn't happen as much as it many years ago as it happens now. Films, I gather, in the old days were either written by a group of people. One person would write the structure, one person would do the dialogue, one person would come in and make it funny and so forth. But these people were all under hire, under contract, and understood that what their jobs were. Or if the writers who worked with my father essentially wrote the script, and that was it. There were not two or three other writers coming in behind them.
Well, Nicholas Kazan, thank you very much for talking
about
this.
Thanks, Jerry.
Nicholas Kazan wrote the screenplay for the new movie Reversal of Fortune. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, President Bush is sending the Secretary of State, James Baker, to Baghdad to negotiate?
Very big news, yes, to negotiate with Saddam Hussein. The president says the area for negotiation is very limited. He wants Saddam Hussein to leave Kuwait, and that's what he wants. However, progress of some sort seems to be being made, some kind of activity. Tariq Aziz, the foreign minister, will be coming here as well. So we will have a series of reports on tonight's program about this, Terry.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Commentator Maureen Corrigan reviews a lot of books about feminism for us. So when Robert Bly's new book about the men's movement, Iron John, came out, she felt compelled to read it to figure out how the other half thinks.
I've always mentally quarantined the poet Robert Bly with other literary victims of testosterone poisoning, writers like D.H. Lawrence, Jack Kerouac, and, of course, Ernest Hemingway. If you like your poetry studded with phallic symbols, Bly is your man. During the last decade, Bly has attracted lots of new fans, not because of his poetry, but because of the men's encounter groups he's been leading. Bly and his followers take men out into the woods to get in touch with the wild man within. For a few days, these men dance around fires, wave swords, yodel like Tarzan, and forget to floss. These wild man gatherings are easy to ridicule, but they also seem to address some real pain and confusion that many men feel these days. That's why Iron John is worth reading, despite its mystical glorification of the Y chromosome. In Iron John, Bly tries to do for men what Betty Friedan did for women almost 30 years ago in The Feminine Mystique. He tries to identify the problem without a name, the vague sense of unhappiness that haunts many American men. Bly says that the most repeated phrase in his men's gatherings is, "There is not enough father." In other words, men feel that their fathers were too remote. Iron John is one book that doesn't blame men's problems on an all-devouring Freudian monster mother. In fact, Bly even credits the women's movement with helping men to develop their feminine side. But he thinks lots of men have gone too far. He says the new soft male is a nice boy who pleases not only his mother, but also the young woman he is living with. In fact, he pleases everybody but himself. As a substitute for the male mentors they didn't have, Bly urges men to study fairy tales, myths, legends, the treasure trove of literature that teaches men and women how to grow up. Bly structures his own book around a psychological reading of the Grimm's brothers' tale of Iron John. He's a hairy giant who lives underwater and eats dogs and soldiers for breakfast. A real tough guy. One day, though, Iron John befriends a boy and initiates him into the secrets of manhood. How to leave his parents, how to fight, and how to love. There's a lot I don't like about Robert Bly's book. I wince at his cryptic writing style. Sentences like, "The father gives with his sperm a black overcoat around the soul." Huh? And I think he really overrates the value of fantasy stories and ancient gods as role models for modern men. In fact, Bly's wild man movement has a lot in common with the mushy, metaphysical feminism of Mary Daly. She's into goddesses and advises women to concentrate on spiritual rather than political change. But I think that Bly is onto something here about American men and their confusion about what it means to be a man these days. I just hope that the next writer who tackles this subject has more practical guidance to offer than shaggy dog stories about hairy fairies.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. She reviewed Robert Bly's new book, Iron John. Our reviews are produced by Naomi Person. Our interviews are produced by Amy Sallet and Phyllis Myers. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. And me, I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, director Jim Jarmusch tells us about making his offbeat films Stranger Than Paradise, Down by Law, and Mystery Train. And we talk about the blues and soul with guitarist and singer Robert Cray. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.